This is Friedberg New Church Assembly, Thursday, August 5th. This is the second lecture. My name is F. Robert Toffel, known sometimes as F. Bob, and my subject is the Jordan River. And I deliberately chose to kind of zoom in, but I'll be zooming in and out. The Jordan River is a powerful metaphor representing the border or entry point of the promised land of Canaan, which nearly everyone understands to be the heavenly way of life. Swedenborgians, owing to the doctrine of correspondences formulated by Emanuel Swedenborg, can see more to this great river than what everyone nearly sees on the surface as the entryway into the heavenly life. I want to look a little bit at the Jordan River, its geography, the symbolism of water in general, and then I want to take a few three or four, depending on how the time goes, Bible stories about things that happen at the Jordan River, and then look at reflecting on it and then seeing what Swedenborg has to say about it. The Jordan River actually starts up in the mountains and goes for about 100 miles and then another 100 miles. One of the most striking aspects of the geography, I don't know how anyone went into detail about it, but this whole landmass is a solid crystalline formation. And this area that we see as the Mediterranean over here periodically would overflow, so it didn't keep to its border through the millions of years. More or less in Bible times it was more or less there, but so that affects the different kinds of stones, that sand and so forth. But below, there's this crystalline mass and the fault lines and volcanic action, and the Mount Sinai, which some scholars do not think was a volcano, but certainly the signs are there with all the basalt and lava that's around, and the fact of the pillar of fire at night and cloud of day. There are people that reject that hypothesis. It's just an intriguing one. One of the symbolisms to me, and I think that Swedenborg would bear it out, at least William Worcester points this out, is that starting about 650 feet above the sea level, going down to minus nearly 1,300 more at the base of the Salt Sea, it's 1,300 feet deep perhaps, is a picture, a dramatic picture, of the accommodation of divine truth to every level as we go down the river. And George and others have pointed out how this is, I've got a little J over here for Jericho and a G for Gilgal, and this is one of the entry ways to the heavenly life, the Holy Land. Water is useful for, we need water for our bodies. We need it in the earth. Water performs one main function, is that of dissolving and providing nutriment. The water comes into the forest and it helps the decay process. So that plants, obviously we need water to grow plants. Within our body, we have the same need for water. People are recognizing more the need for water, to carry water around with us, because we probably, most of us, don't get enough water during the course of a day. We're supposed to have the 12 glasses, but we don't always get it. And then we think, then, what does water do in our spirit? Water performs a washing or purification process, and it is also the interaction of our truth with our will, our heart and our mind. This is a fairly big print, so don't get excited if I go through a lot of pages. This is 18 point type. It's not 12 point type. So summarizing, the Jordan River rises from the springs of Mount Hermon up in Syria. I think George mentioned that up that area. It flows 100 miles and then into the Lake Hula. This is Lake Hula here, and then this is 10 more miles down to Galilee. And it makes its first 700 feet drop in that distance, and then it falls the rest on the way down. Water circulates around the world and within our body and within our mind, and it's very important that we kind of see what the role of truth is, the role of the Bible and the Ten Commandments. The simple truths of the Bible help us in our everyday vocations, but also our spiritual life. Truth, and this is I like William Worcester's way of putting it, truth that shows the relation of things to us and how we can make them useful is the water that gives spiritual food a relish and sets it moving in the currents of our mind. In this case, the spiritual water is the truth that shows how we can appropriate and use good things. And this is especially important in our relationships. The more we know, for example, about another person, the better we can relate to them. We understand what's going on in their stresses in their lives. The more we know in our relationships, the more easily and patiently we can endure their problems and offer our assistance. Because as in anything else, what we don't know is what becomes problematic. So if we lift our thoughts from natural water to spiritual water, the plain truth of life with its corresponding uses, we do well to remember the Lord's way of teaching using parable stories and then drawing from them. In a similar way, the Bible comes to us inviting us to find refreshing, invigorating, life-giving truths for this new age. And as we look around us, we could find many reasons for despair, but I would only point out that it was no easier for the fellow traveling down from Jerusalem to Jericho, falling amongst thieves, or for the disciples who faced their persecution and death because of their faith. So the Lord has always used this world as a means of developing the future world. The first story I want to go into has to do with Joshua, and we usually think of Joshua and what? Jericho, Joshua and Jericho. But I'm going to go back before that, and I'm going to remember that the children of Israel first had the Exodus, and then they had the conquest. And as I understand it, and I think it'll be borne up by discussion, the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea first. And then they spent all this time over in the wilderness testing what? Whether they would follow the Lord or no. That was through all the main incidents in that 40 years. It did two things. One, Lee mentioned, I think, that the people that had the slave experience, someone mentioned that that generation died off, and then it was the new generation that eventually at one point gathered and went over. And it's in the Joshua chapter 3 and 4, and I'd like to just read a little bit of it. So this was one morning, early in the morning, not exactly what day, but early one morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. After 3 days, the officers went through the camp giving orders to the people. When you see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God and the priests who are Levites carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go, since you have never gone this way before. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark. Do not go near it. And Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do great things among you. Take the ark and pass on ahead of the people. So they took it up and went ahead. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of Israel so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river. And Joshua said to the Israelites, come here and listen to the words of the Lord. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and he will certainly drive out the Canaanites, Hittites, and all the tribes. See, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men, one from each tribe, as soon as the priests who carry the ark of the Lord set foot in the Jordan. Its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. So when the people broke camp, the priests carrying the ark of the covenant went ahead of them. And now we learn what the big problem is. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during the harvest. The Jordan River is 5 feet deep most of the time, but in the harvest time, perhaps it's March in our calendar. As soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up a heap a great distance away, and while the water was flowing down to the Sea of Arabah, or the Salt Sea, was completely cut off, so the people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the ark stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed crossing on dry ground. And then when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among you, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them with you and put them down at the place where you stay for the night. And so he did that. Now, the central message of the crossing is that we don't take the Holy Land by ourselves. We don't take it by force. It's the Lord that has to do that. And what was in the ark? The Ten Commandments, the new version, the new unrevised version, chiseled out because Moses broke the first, and there were remembrance items in it, and so the Ten Commandments essentially were leading them, and strategically, perhaps from a battle standpoint, 1,000 yards would be about third of a mile, something like that. Over half a mile, and watching these people go down across the people. I mean, there were a lot of people. We don't know how many there were, but they would then see the time to go. And what does the Jordan River represent? It's water in this great valley. But they were sitting there for 3 days, sitting there, walking there, eating there. They were camped for 3 days over here, looking at the Jordan, looking across. It was flood stage, so it was probably very discouraging. They were trying to have to gather themselves. How are we going to get across this? And the Jordan River doesn't represent truths of good until that time. It represents falsities of evil because of the inhabitants of the land. It's only after the crossing, the waters heap up, the children of Israel go across with the ark of the Ten Commandments. From that point on, then, the Jordan River is going to represent truth that initiates us into the good or heavenly life. And it's essentially truth that's going to marry itself with the good, because the good was the desire for the heavenly life that was achieved through all this. People say wasted time, 40 years in the wilderness. If Mrs. Moses might have said, "Gee, if only men would ask directions," but that's a profanation of truth. Really, it was a case where they had to really decide would they follow the Lord or not, and it was through that process and all the different tests of the bad water and the no water and the no food and the manna and the quail and all these experiences in the wilderness that prepared them then. We want that good life. And George mentioned 12-step programs. To stop drinking is the first thinking that in AA, that's the thing that we can do. To do what I can do, to have courage to do what I can do, and wisdom to know what I can't do. There are a lot of things I can't change. I can't change my height. I can't change what I've done till this point. But there are some things that I can change. That's what the Ten Commandments do, is they tell us to make everything level in the most external part of our life, because this is the flattest part. And as George was saying, you then got to climb up the hills, the Judean hills. But it was achievable for them to cross the river at the lowest point, and to camp at Gilgal. That's that little G right there. I'm covering up all this, but that's okay. We can draw the map. You remember there's a little circle there and a bigger one there. And then interestingly, I never could have figured this out. When I decided I wanted to talk about the Jordan River and its symbolism and to take a few Bible stories from it. But what they do is they take the southern part first. And they eventually get over to Gaza. And then it's chapter 11 of Joshua where they start the northward take. So that's about all there is to the external story. Now, Joshua was the pastor from Swedenborg. I've got some quotes from Swedenborg, more than I'm going to use, because it's always that way. Joshua was to pass over Jordan on the third day, and the passage of Jordan represented introduction of the regenerate into the Lord's kingdom. Joshua, who led them, represented the Lord himself. So this was... And using the ark, and the ark was always preceding them in the conquest. If you follow the movie that was made of their efforts, well, they thought it was. That's not exactly right. By the Jordan being divided and their passing over on dry ground, there was signified the removal of the evils and falsities, and the admission of those who are in goods and truths. And this is that word that George was referring to. See it right here. That's the people that are in. The miracle of the dividing of the Jordan is signified introduction of the faithful into the church. And again, these are the people that are following Joshua. These are the people that have been tried and true. And then they're the ones that are going to, as for me and my house, we're going to follow the Lord. It also represents... this is the external, right? And this is the internal. It shows that we by our life, by a civil and moral life in the world, through our worldly life and trying to apply the truths of religion to our external life, we then prepare ourselves to receive the internal. And so we can't just think our way into heaven. After the people had passed over and the waters returned, then those same waters signified the truths which introduced. So this was a major, major change in the Holy Land with the conquest by Joshua. And in the rocks from the bottom. I think it's fascinating that they always, and it's because there's so much sand around. Rocks are the things, you know, they always make these rocks of testimonies. They pile up a heap of rocks in Abraham's time and from all that time. Let these stones represent, you know, this agreement that we've made. And these stones of remembrance would be sedimentary rocks because they'd be from the bottom of the river. And they represent how the truth is distilled over the years. So Joshua is the first one I want to take. And then... this is one of my favorite stories, the one of Naaman the leper, who asks he's a commander, and he asks his king, can I go over there and get myself healed over in Israel? Because, you know, I guess the stories of healing had gotten around. And he said, sure, not only that, I'll send a letter ahead of me. Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram, and he was a great man in the sight of his master, highly regarded, because The Lord had given him victory in Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now, bands from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. And he said, "By all means, go. I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 sets of clothing. I mean, he was ready for a big trip. You think you're coming to camp is tough. The letter they took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." And of course that wasn't received too good. I like this one. "As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, 'Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See, he's trying to pick a quarrel with me.'" That's the way they worked in those days, to give them Mission Impossible. "When Elisha heard that the king had torn his robes, he sent him a message, 'Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there's a prophet in Israel.' So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house." And this is where the trouble begins, at least from Naaman's side. Elisha sends a messenger to him and says, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored and you'll be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry, furious. "I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord and wave his hand and cure me of the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel?" See, this is way downstream from up there, the Euphrates. So he turned, and like so many people, when they hear the answer to their problems, he turned and went off in a rage. Now Naaman's servants went and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? How much more then when he tells you to go and be cleansed?" So he went down and dipped himself into the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. This is such a dramatic story of misconceptions and preconceptions. We figure out how the Lord's going to take care of us. And we do well to remember the second song that we had there, "The Lord's My Shepherd." He leads us and he helps us to figure out what to do. I don't think I'll skip that. The waters of Jordan signified truths by that time, which introduced into the church. On account, and this is from Swedenborg, "On account of this signification of the waters of Jordan, Naaman was commanded to wash himself 7 times, by which was signified purification from falsified truth." Now, diagnostically, the Swedenborg says leprosy is a disease that's caused almost anyone could have leprosy. It's we know what's true and what's good and right for us, but we don't always follow it. And so we know the truths of right religion, but we don't follow them. And we all do that to some extent or another, hopefully very little, but it's something we can almost hardly escape. But we don't necessarily get leprosy, so people don't know it. That's pretty much what Swedenborg says about Naaman's, but it's just one more example of the correspondence. So once these waters represent basic, simple truths of the Bible that lead us into the good of life, or marry with the will to lead the good life and give us the strength. What is it? Love does not have power without wisdom. And we need both sides to us. I picked all the how I went. You might know my my methodology here was to look in the concordance and find out wherever Swedenborg talked about the Jordan River. And the next one in line is that great event when Elijah and Elisha, I used to always get them mixed up, but Elijah came first and Elisha was able to see him taken up in a whirlwind. And so all the powers that Elijah had, like that curing of Naaman, Elisha got. And not everybody has this experience, because Elijah was given to know when he was going that, you know, that he was going to be taken. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and you live, I will not leave you." So they went together. The company of the prophets at Bethel came up out to Elisha and said, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know it," Elisha said, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. And the company of the prophets of Jericho went out to Elisha and said, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men of the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance, facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak and rolled it up and struck the water with it. And the water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours, otherwise not." As they were walking and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. And Elijah saw this and cried out, "My father, my father!" And the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. And Elisha saw him no more. And he took off his own clothes and tore them apart. And he picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. And when he struck the water, it divided to the right and the left, and he crossed over. And so that was a sign to him that he had gotten the spirit. And the company of the prophets of Jericho were watching and said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." And they went to meet him and bowed to the ground and said, "Lord, we, your servants, have 50 able men. Let them go and look for your master. Perhaps the spirit of the Lord has picked him up and set him down on the mountain or in some other valley." They must have had tornadoes in those days too, huh? "No," Elisha replied, "do not send them." But they persisted until he was too ashamed to refuse. And so he said, "Go send them." And they went out for 3 days. And when they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, "Didn't I tell you not to go?" Wasting their time. Well, this one, once again, the smiting, King James Version, smiting the river and making it stop, shows that he had power from the Lord to turn the evils into good. And the last story I want to take is from the baptism. It's from John. And it's not exactly as in the Synoptic Gospels or Mark and Matthew and Luke. And it's the baptism in the Jordan, and then a vignette about Jesus later. John replied, they were asking him why he was baptizing the Pharisees. John replied to them in the words of Isaiah the prophet. They were saying, who are you to be doing this? I am the voice of one calling in the desert, make straight the way of the Lord. Now some Pharisees who had been sent questioned him, why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? I baptize with water, John replied, but among you stands one you do not know. He is the one that comes after me, the thongs of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie. The next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is the one I meant when I said, a man who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. I myself did not know him, but the reason I came baptizing with water was that he might be revealed to Israel. Then John gave this testimony. I saw the Spirit come down from heaven as a dove and remain on him. I would not have known him except the one who sent me to baptize with water told me. The man on whom you see the Spirit come down and remain is the one who will baptize with the Holy Spirit. I have seen and I testify, this is the Son of God. John's is slightly different because it doesn't exactly say that he baptized Jesus. The others do. And then that was from the first chapter. And then the 10th chapter, this was interesting to me. At the point, I don't recall exactly the context, but it says, then Jesus went back across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days. Here he stayed. And in that place, many believed in Jesus. So that was intriguing to me because of the memory of what John had testified about Jesus took hold with the people there. And so when Jesus came back, they recognized him and believed. And these are probably factoids that you know already. Jordan equals initiation into the knowledges of good and truth is from the fact that it was the boundary of the land of Canaan. And for the same reason, John baptized in the Jordan, because the Jordan signified introduction into the church. For it was the first boundary of the land of Canaan where the church was. And again there. A little more deeply. As by the waters of Jordan are signified the truths which introduce into the church, which are knowledges of truth and good from the word, and by washing therein was signified purification from falsities, and the consequent reformation and regeneration by the Lord. Therefore, baptizing was instituted, which was first done in Jordan by John. Now there were, of course, the purification rites, right? I mean, the people knew all about the representation of having water in your house and all the rites about purification using water. But the difference is that they were all symbolic or just representative until Jesus came. And then this idea of water actually purifying us rather than just representing. And that's why we in the Swedenborgian church say the waters of baptism don't effect regeneration. They represent it. And the Lord alone will regenerate. What they represent is the purification of our external lives by following the principles that we know to be right. And if we first receive these principles and truths and acknowledge them to be true, then if we take the second step of actually reforming our lives by living according to them, then the Lord can do the regeneration. And of course, this is a lifelong process, lifelong meaning forever, because we're always progressing. Well, that's good. We managed the time. I didn't read every word, so we have some time. This was such a mega symbol, is why I wanted it, and it pushes all of the. It connects with everything that has been said and will be said, and just pushes the envelope a little bit with the idea of accommodation that George just said, right? Absolute truth only exists with the Lord, and there is absolute truth, but it's accommodated by the evaporation, and then it comes down, and then it rolls down. Richard?
Yeah.
Okay, you go first. You have the microphone, and then take it.
I haven't asked one yet. I've been too busy, it seems, the first few days trying to keep up with this. But not to do with your lecture, but just one thing. As you read the story, I'm a bit confused. I think it was Elisha and Naaman.
Elijah. I always mix them up, too, but it was Elijah.
Oh, okay. But it's when he said to the king, let the people know there's a prophet in Israel. I would like to think he would have said, let the people know that there's a God in Israel, and it's the one God, and I'm his prophet. You know, give the credit immediately to God rather than, maybe that was assumed, but and it's not really important, but I just thought it just seemed like it would have been nicer if he mentioned God before himself.
It is important, and it probably was assumed.
I found this very fascinating. Thanks. And also, I get interested when I start thinking things I didn't think before, which isn't that often. And
sure, it is.
Like looking at the Jordan River and seeing the. Seeing it as like the source of life, and you've got the Sea of Galilee above it, where Jesus was. I just thinking about proximity and where life is and where life isn't, and it's in. I just find it interesting the proximity of Jerusalem there at the. Is the mouth of the Dead Sea?
It's just opposite. It's just opposite over here. There's a big tall row of hills here and a big tall row of hills here. And the breezes come across, and they go up the mountains. And on this side, there's water. That's where Jerusalem and Bethlehem and all. And it goes over to the other side. It's not just
desert. It just seems to me like the Jerusalem represents a little line of what above that line is the gate to what's spiritual. And it's interesting that Jesus was up in Galilee, which was in the source of where the river was.
Well, you just get right at it, which is what George was talking about, you know, the cosmopolitan area up there. And the people would say, can any good come from Nazareth? You know, I mean, the people down here in Judea. Dorothea Harvey is going to talk. I mean, she's been there. And I read a book on geography and found it scintillating. It was just fascinating. But I'm not a geologist or a geographer. And the interplay with all the upfolding and the actions that take place and the different kind of rocks and everything, but there's the row of hills there and then this is a huge valley. This is called the Great Rift Valley. It just goes way down, you know, the 1,300 feet, but there's this one place where you can kind of cross here, and there's a place up. George was referring to it then up there, but Jesus was born up here. And they had to go down to Bethlehem because of his father, his stepfather, being from the house and lineage of David. And then there was Bethany, which was people that, you know, Lazarus and Mary and Martha, where they loved him, and then he would be able to stay with them. When he went down to Jerusalem, they'd stay at Bethany. He'd go in and out to the temple and so forth. But up here with the cosmopolitan folks was where he really did his parable work and his healing work and so forth.
I guess my question was, is there a correspondence somehow as to why, you've got the Dead Sea where there is no life, and above it there is the beginnings of life?
There's just little vegetation and just some brackish shrimp, not much. But it is there, and this, I believe, I didn't complete the thought. I think if we ask Dorothea, I think that's where the wilderness is. I don't think that you can. I've got a picture showing the wilderness, the jungle of Jordan, and it's really quite amazing. All kinds of weird and dangerous animals. I don't think that's a very good place for life down there because of the Dead Sea. Also because, on the shore, I mean the ship people, Tyre and what's the other one, Sidon? And Gaza, the Gaza Strip down here. You know, that's a good place this time of year, right? I mean, on the banks of the Mediterranean. So as George was always saying a lot of time, you know, you'd come up the Nile and you go swooping up the coast and you could go over the Tigris. You know, and back and forth, and then I'm going to push the envelope even farther about the Holy Land with the seven churches, which would be about up where the ceiling is there, up over the top. But I just think that is not very. I think that's the wilderness of Judea. That's where John went out baptizing. People from Jerusalem went out into the wilderness. That's kind of a nowhere place. I don't think there'd even be like a City Line store there. But I think to answer the question, I think that'd be a good question for me to consult the geography book, but us to consult Dorothea Harvey, who's really privileged to be there. And she's going to talk about walking in the land. She'll be here tomorrow and giving a lecture, Walking in the Land. And I think that would be a very good question, and I'm sure one that she'd be able to answer. I'm glad you picked up on the enthusiasm. I just love those stories. I thought the prophet would wave his hand. You know, we always figured the Lord would do things the easy way, right? Instead of having to go wash in the river and, you know, learn truths and follow them. It'd be easier, wouldn't it, if we just sign up and say we believe. You've been a very good audience. Thank you.